podcast that was Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm speaking to Emma Stamp, who is the former ECD of Adam and Eve DDB in London. She's also worked at a few other agencies, including Legas Delaney and Miles Carcroft, Bringish or Duffy, and DDB before it joined together with Adam and Eve. And she's done lots of very interesting work. I guess I'll have put a lot of it on the blog by the time you're hearing this. And we discuss a lot of it. I think clearly her most famous working campaign is John Lewis, which not only did a great job of propelling that store to the front of mind for Christmas for a lot of people, and people still talk about the John Lewis Christmas ad now. That was her, along with her partner Ben Tollett. So, I mean, launching an entire genre of advertising, that's pretty amazing. All these minute-long, tear-jerking, sentimental retail Christmas ads. You didn't have them until John Lewis came around. And then we talk a little bit about Emma's career, her current career as a children's author, which is, incredibly successful. And, her books are about to be turned into an animated series involving Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. So rather than me preempt the entire chat, why don't I just let you listen to it? Okay, so thanks for making the time to speak, Emma, on this beautiful morning. It is the morning Trump has been elected, so we'll just sort of skim over that and talk about more pleasant things. So thanks for making the time.
Yeah. So We can talk about what? We could talk, not Trump, Starbucks. That's what I write about now, so it seems pretty.
That's true. Okay. Well, we'll get to that, I'm sure. So as I tend to start with other people, why and how did you get into advertising in the first place?
Right. Oh, well, that's like many, many years ago. And I think almost 20 years ago. So I studied, I did A-level art, and then I kind of wanted to get into design, but I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. So I did a foundation course. And on that foundation course, when we were deciding what to do at university, a friend of mine kind of swayed me, and he was like, hey, I'm looking at this course at Bucks College. And I was like, ooh, he said, it's really hard to get into. So I was like, I must go and have a look at this. So I had no interest in advertising at all, but the course was illustrating graphic design and advertising. So I got a place, and I basically got into this place. It's hard to get into. My friend didn't go, so I was a bit gutted. So through that, I kind of got into advertising, and I got a job. I got offered a job in my second year while I was on placement, which took me into a particularly good agency. But, you know, I was off and I was running, and that was it, really. I kind of worked from there.
So is Bucks, pardon my ignorance, Bucks a three-year course then?
Yes, it was. So the first year is kind of like you do all of the disciplines, and then you had to specialise in the first year. And actually, it was the year, I don't know what the Guinness spot was. It was the one where the guy did kind of crazy dancing, and I was going to do graphic design, and that spot came out. I was like, oh no, I really like this spot. I want to do that. And that was it. That was really actually what swayed me. It was that dancing. I can't remember what he did now. It just went to that da 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 da
tune. Dancing around the pint. I think that was Mehdi Nerouzi, and I've never known how to pronounce his surname, who
that's your encyclopedic knowledge for you. I don't have that. I just da 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 da.
That's the one, yes. That's the punters.
We'll know. They're probably responsible, actually, whoever wrote that is probably responsible for me going into advertising instead of doing graphic design, which I'd already signed up to do.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sure they'll be very happy to know that. Just so I get a sense, because if we ever left Watford early, like, our tutor would be like, you're just not ready and all this kind of stuff. So leaving in your second year, was that a big deal?
I think actually I left halfway through my third year. My tutor, I don't know if he was not very happy. It's hard to tell, but I didn't get a very good mark. That might have been because I wasn't very good, or I don't know. So I think I got marked down a grade for leaving early, but I was like, well, it doesn't really matter if you have a 2-1 or a 2-2 when you have a job. So,
Oh yeah, it's a proper degree. I remember getting my my HND at Watford, because ours is just a year long, so it's just a diploma.
Yeah.
And binning it sort of ceremonially in my mind, because I kind of thought, if I ever need this HND in copywriting and art direction, I'm screwed. So I kind of got rid of it, and that was kind of where I went to from there.
So I don't think I even went to pick up my certificates, and no, I just carried on.
And did you team up with Ben there? Is that where you?
No, I actually teamed up. I had a partner called Charlotte, and we worked for a couple of years. So our first job was at FCB, all long gone names. Yeah. And then they merged with Banks Wilkins O'Shea. And it was kind of a weird merger, and obviously we were on the wrong side of it, and we got made redundant. She decided she wanted to be a journalist. She didn't think there was enough money in advertising. And so she went off to do that, and I was kind of like the dumped other half. So I then kind of went around to the, what do? You go to the headhunters, like a singles kind of affair, and they gave me a load of names. I met lots of people in cafes, like a sort of strange dating agency. And then I met Ben. And we just decided to start working together. I think he'd been let go from Mother, and he had teamed up with someone and was on a placement at BBH, and I convinced him to dump his placement and come and work with me.
So what do you think? Was it a, like, we get on very well personality thing, or was there something in his book that made you?
Well, Ben was very simple, and he'd been to Mother, and he had a good book, and I was like, clearly he's good. I need someone good to work with. And yeah, we got on. We always got on really well, actually. And I think we both had the same drive. We were both quite nuts. We both never kind of gave up, like a sort of dog with a bone. So yeah, we started doing a place. Well, actually, we were doing placements. I think we did some freelance, because we kind of just told everyone we've worked before, so we should freelance. We shouldn't get a placement. And we actually nearly got a placement at DDB, but they didn't have us, and they could have had us on placement long before they had to pay us a lot of money to come back. But yeah, and then luckily we got a job at Leagues Delaney. That was our first job. So yeah, we put our book in, and Ian Duck and Will Farquhar were kind enough to offer us a job. Well, through Tim Delaney, obviously. So yeah, that's where it all began. So I think we had 3 years under the tutorage of Tim Delaney, which was a very good, actually. It was like a boot camp in advertising, but a very, very worthwhile one doing.
Well, you'll probably find my next podcast really interesting, because it's Dave Dye's Leagues Delaney years, and
right.
you might hear some interesting stories there. I mean, I'd actually be interested in the context of that to hear how it was for you, because like when he was there, there was this incredible department. You know, Paul and Nigel were there, and Tony Davidson, Kim Patworth, and as you said, Will and Ian, and people like that. Was it the same then, or was it on its, I mean, it took a long time, but it was a slightly more downward, it had a peak in the 90s, I'd say, let's be polite. And then it seems to have gone a little bit off from there. Because I remember seeing your work from Leagues Delaney in DNAD, I think, maybe 2001 or two or something. So you were doing good work then.
2000?
Yeah, maybe 2000. So evidently really good work was still happening. So what was it actually like day to day at Leagues in those years?
It was quite nuts. We were definitely, I think we joined in the agency collapse. No, it wasn't quite like that, but we were probably on a more downward trajectory. So we joined and the BBC left, and this was nothing to do with us. And then I think Bark, I don't know, it kind of, yeah, it was slowly going down, but there were still great, great people there, and we learned loads from them. But it was totally crazy. I mean, we used to it made you very tight as a department, actually, working in such a nuts environment. There were two things. So we'd all sit around at lunch and all watch the rolling news, so the news would just all sit there. And then we would, at night, because we worked pretty much every night late, we would all end up sitting in front of the rolling news during the night, waiting for Tim to call us in for a view. So I've got really strong memories of just watching the news whilst it was about 3 or 4 in the morning, just waiting for a review, because your review time was like 3:20 a.m. Really? And you would just wait. And then you would have your review, and you could then go home. It was totally nuts. But at the time, you know, you're young and you've got nothing else better to do than to turn up and waste your weekends with Tim Delaney, who is a crazy man. But I actually got on very well with. So I don't know. Everyone has a different opinion of him. He never did me ill, and I've only. I'm not sure you'd say a good time with Tim Delaney, but you know, we definitely had a laugh.
So, I mean, I'm just trying to get my head around this. So you regularly had to have meetings at 3 a.m. Is that like...
Well, no, just generally, because we were always doing a project that always kind of got carried away. It was never as simple as that's the answer. It was always like, that might be the answer, but maybe there's a better one. Let's work till 3 in the morning and find out. And yeah, we'd be like, yeah, of course, this Adidas brief, we need like 20 different answers on. I can't remember what we were doing. It was pitching, or we had Adidas, and obviously that was like a big client. And Tim, I think he had an interest in Fulham Football Club. So was it? It would have been Saturday they play the games, I guess. Is it Saturday? So yeah, it would be like, well, I'm at the football on Saturday, so everyone in on Sunday. And we would just be like, oh, okay, then I guess. But because we were all kind of a similar age and similar kind of like, this is crazy, but we kind of all got on. And actually, I've still got 3 very good friends from Liga Stellini. So the Liga Stellini years were crazy, but they definitely, I don't know, they taught you how to work, that's for sure. I was never work shy after working there. And everything else was a picnic compared to it. So, yeah.
And did you feel when you were there that you were aiming towards some sort of wider career that you had? What are we going to do after Liga Stellini? Was there any kind of feeling like you had a plan?
I don't think we ever had the foresight back then. We were just really keen to do good work, actually. That's all that drove us. We were total annual whores, and we would just pour over. All we wanted to do was be in DNAD. That was kind of the most important thing to us. And we were just looking to places to go to do great creative work. And at the time, it wasn't even, it was never financial. Well, it never really was actually financial. We always did it because we wanted to. We thought it was a better move for us to do better work. And we recognised that towards the end of Liga Stellini that we weren't learning anymore. In fact, Sean Thompson, who we crossed over really briefly with at Liga Stellini, once said to us, once you think that you stop learning anything new, then you should move on. And we've always used that actually as a really good benchmark. Once we felt at an agency that we had kind of maybe learnt everything we could, or we felt that we could learn something new and more interesting somewhere else, then we would move on. So yeah, we kind of felt we'd reached the end there. And then MCVD, again, an agency who doesn't exist anymore, they came in and they'd just started up. I think they were probably only a couple of years old, and that seemed to us like a interesting place to go, somewhere that was kind of trying to get new business and had a kind of different dynamic to it. So that kind of drove us there. And then it was like, oh, well, then DDB, and it was like, oh, that's a good industry, that's a move forward. Again, that's a big agency. We decided we need to go to a big agency. We always had like, oh, we need to go to a big agency now. So we were like, off we must go. We went to a big agency. And then Adam and Eve came along, and they were like, yes, we need to go to a startup now. And this would be good because we'll learn management. So we went off and learned management. And then the next bit, we didn't have much of a say, and it was back to DDB again, back to a big agency. So yeah, it wasn't a career we'd ever mapped out, but I'd definitely say we just followed awards, really, where we thought we could win the most awards.
Okay, well, so just going back into the leave, so you were Liga Stellini for about 3 years. What made you, did you engineer the move to Miles Cowcroft, or did they come calling, or what happened there?
Yeah, no, I think in all the moves we ever made, Liz Harrell played a part. I've got a feeling that a headhunter came and said to us, would you like to go to Miles Cowcroft? And we were like, oh, that sounds interesting. At the same time, CHI and Miles Cowcroft were next to each other, actually. And yeah. CHI was doing really well. They did some of the tango work. So I remember at the time being like, oh, we'd like to go to CHI. But Miles Cowcroft is next door. And I wasn't quite like that, sorry, Paul and Malcolm listening. It seemed like we needed to get out of Liga Stellini. The ship was definitely in rocky waters, and I think we felt we'd learned as much as we could, and we'd written as many headlines as it was physically possible to ever write. So it was time to go and test out doing something a bit different. Cool. So yeah, I think we got headhunted.
Okay. And so working for Paul and Malcolm, that's obviously 2 CDs instead of Tim, who's in charge in one way. What was it like working under those guys?
I imagine it's probably what it was like working for Ben and I, actually. So I should never slag off the 2 CD thing. I think it's very important. It was fine, actually. I mean, they had different opinions about work, but they were great to work for. So yeah, we would just have to kind of navigate. I think when you have 2 CDs that you're working into, you always work out which one you play, which way, don't you? There's always like a good cop, bad cop. And you kind of know, you know, you count, you're like, oh, he looks like, you know, he buys this kind of work and he buys that kind of work. And so you'd kind of like try and pick your days, or, you know, you try and work the system, and they're kind of looking at you thinking, yeah, I know you're trying to work the system. So no, it was interesting. I can't really remember. I think what was funny about Miles Kirkhoff was we went there, and like, we at Liga Spalani, to crack a brief, we'd literally get a pile of A4, we would tear it in half, so we had like little sheets of A5, and then we would just write headlines. That's all Tim ever wanted. So we would just present all the headlines, and then Tim would go, this one, and then we'd put a picture next to it. So we went to Miles Kirkhoff, we did the same, and they were just like, what are you doing? I'm like, this is the headline. They were like, but what's the idea? You know, like, where's the picture? And we're like, oh, we'll do that later. You know, that comes later. Don't worry about that. So yeah, we had to kind of slightly unlearn our sort of over headline heavy approach to life, but it always did us in good stead. You can always solve a problem with a headline.
Yeah, I think you can. I think it's interesting because when you look at a lot of ads with a sort of headline and a visual, they're not quite as conceptual as sort of good things come to those who wait, or happiness is a girl called Hamlet, or something like that. There may just be a really good headline, and the concept is almost more a strategic overall thing sometimes. So, and I'm just so wondering, did you do more TV and branch into other media there? Is that the other thing that happened at Miles Kirkhoff?
Well, the main thing we did there actually that got us hired at DDB was we did the Travelocity work with dear old Alan Wicker, God rest his soul. So we definitely branched into TV. And I think we had a notion, like, we could do funny stuff, and we wanted to do funny stuff. Liga Spalani hadn't really let us scratch that itch, so to speak. And Ben and I have a very strange sense of humour, and we were allowed to kind of run riot with Alan Wicker and do all sorts of terrible things to him. I think that was probably the work we did there. And we wrote a campaign for Millets as well, which was very well awarded using our writing skills. So Tim Delaney helped us with that one, and then we made our own way with Tim, Paul and Malcolm's help into TV.
I was going to ask about Millets, because it was obviously not an awardee client. Like, when you get a Nike brief or a VW brief or a Harvey Nichols brief, you go, oh, right, well, I've got a client people vote for, let's, you know, give it everything. So what was it like when you got the Millets brief? Did you think, oh, this could be potentially an award thing? Or did you just go, well, we'll do our best and cross our fingers?
Do you know what? I don't really remember. You should speak to Ben about this. He's got this, like, crazy encyclopedic memory about things. The client came in. I think the client was lovely, and I think I can remember it was he. And he was just really up for doing some interesting stuff. And I think we were at that point as well in our careers where we were just sort of just been starting out, and we had that sort of, like, anything's possible. Like, you know, why wouldn't this client make some good work? We weren't that sort of slightly long in the teeth, we hadn't got to that place where we were like, oh, this client will never do good work. We were just like, oh, of course they will. They'll buy this. We'll write an ad about their, I think it was a print ad about you could use it as toilet paper to buy for us while you're out camping. Why won't he buy this? Of course he'll buy this. And he did. I mean, I don't know. It's like, he was very brave. I mean, he made a campaign of, great work, probably great work for us. I'm not sure that, I don't think it propelled the brand up the high street network any further or faster, but it did very well for us, and I'm very grateful. But yeah, I don't think we gave it a second thought at the time. I just thought, yeah, let's go for it.
And if my memory serves me correctly, you definitely won at least one gold at Campaign Press for that, if not two, maybe, I don't know. The award sort of landscape has changed a little bit then, but there were only about four or five big awards to win in those days, like, you know, outside DND, Campaign Press and Posters and BTAA. So winning that must have put you on a sort of different level, or some sort of, you know, the way you were perceived must have been a bit more, you know, a bit more positive. Did you feel a kind of difference between that pre-winning that kind of award and afterwards?
Casting my mind back, I'm not really sure we did. I don't know. It was because it's like when you win an award, you kind of think it's going to, I think when you haven't won one, you think it's going to change everything, and all of a sudden you're going to find, like, the happiness that you had never been able to find before. And actually then you win an award and you're a bit like, oh, and you kind of, you get really drunk, and that's the best bit of it. Actually, the best bit of it is actually sitting there hoping you're going to win it, and then when they call your name, that's kind of like, from then on, it's like the downward spiral, because you're just like, oh, we've planet. So I'm not sure that we really felt much of it. And obviously Jeremy Cragan rang us. So we've done enough work for Jeremy to pick up the phone. And actually, he called us after 2 years at MCBD, and we actually said to him, oh, no, we think we've got some more work we'd like to do. We want to do another round of Alan Wicker. So we said, why don't you call us back in a year? And good to his word, he did. So we did another Alan Wicker campaign, and he picked up the phone again. And we were like, okay, yeah, now we're ready to go. So we went to DDB.
That sounds like a very mature attitude to, like, because I think a lot of people, particularly when DDB come calling and Jeremy comes calling, you're like, oh my God, this is, because I know Miles Carcroft obviously did a lot of good work. A lot of it was down to you at that time as well. But DDB, Jeremy Cragan felt like some sort of, not award factory, but the level of work's amazing. So, I mean, hats off to you for having that sort of, I guess, confidence.
Talk life through endlessly. Everything, nothing was a simple decision for us. We would procrastinate and debate, and we decided that we should do another this and that because at DDB we'd get lost in the machine potentially. Oh, okay. We could do work independently at Miles Calcroft that we wouldn't be surrounded by all these people, that we had a more chance of, was it Big Fish Little Pond, whatever it is. Yeah. So there was like a madness to everything we did, a well thought through madness. But, and you know what, it could have easily not worked for us as well. We could have done nothing all year. Jeremy didn't call it again. You know, the trajectory could have gone a very different way. So, yeah, we were lucky.
And the Alan Wicker stuff, it was very popular as well. It was stuff that caught a bit more of the imagination in terms of the public. Was that, because I know you were talking about you wanted to get into DNAD, you wanted to get into DNAD, but was having a famous campaign really satisfying as well?
Oh, yeah, hugely so, actually. And in retrospect, Alan Wicker hardly ever won any, he didn't win any awards for us, I say Alan Wicker. Travelocity, a bronze at the British Arrows, I think we got that for it, and maybe we got in book. I don't know, pointing in that respect, but it was lovely that for the first time you could tell someone that you'd done that work. And it was great working with him. The experience, to be honest, it's like that whole experience of working with him, of going, I think we went to South Africa and Thailand and Jersey. We went to Alan Wicker's house and he cooked us lunch, okay? That's all you need to do the job. Yeah. It was like, he then cooked us lunch, and then we drove to some tiny little recording studio and made some radio ads. I mean, it was kind of a nuts time. So it was, yeah, it was nice that people recognised the work, but it was also just a time in that you don't really get anymore. You don't get to go to Thailand for 3 weeks and just hang out in a resort that hadn't opened yet. It was a brand new resort, and we just hung out there and made these kind of crazy ads. So yeah, it was a brilliant, brilliant experience. At the time, I thought it was going to go on forever and be the same for the rest of my career. I didn't realise it was a place called Black Island.
Oh yeah.
I was going to end up on a, what do you call it, in a studio, probably shooting. That was like the last time I went abroad. Black Island it was for the rest of my life.
And was Alan, because the one I remember particularly was the one where he had his moustache lit up. Was Alan always game? Was he game for the funny things that you made him do?
He was really game, actually. God bless. He was amazing to work with. And I have to say, this shows our naivety. So when we originally wrote the campaign, I think it was just all about him coming, him basically saying hello world. And we wrote these scripts, and it was like, it was literally like, oh, I think there were 10 seconds. And it was like, Alan Wicker comes out of a cow's ass and says, hello world. Alan Wicker pops out of a toilet and says, hello world. And we sent these to Alan Wicker. Can you believe how stupid we are? We sent these to Alan Wicker, and he says it. He doesn't have an agent. He comes back and says, like, I really don't think this is appropriate. And we were gutted. Like, come on, Alan, what are you thinking? Of course you want to get in that cow. So yeah, we were clearly just kind of stupid at that point, as well as having some talent. He was very professional to work with, and he would learn all his lines and then make up his, that was kind of frustrating for the director, so we'd have to then have boards up, and Alan would be like, I don't read off boards. We'd be like, well, but we just need to get you to say these things so that it fits in the time length, because he would do it like a presenter, just like a TV show. But yeah, he liked it all. I mean, we had him, his moustache flashed. Well, Thailand was a baking hot shoot, and he was a man in his late 70s, and we were frying him in the sun. I mean, we were sitting in a swimming pool while he was doing his takes in the sunshine. I mean, honestly, it was so wrong.
Okay, so moving on again back to your career move. So Jeremy rings you up again, very good memory, yeah. Probably put in his diary. And then obviously you make that move. So what's DDB like at that time?
DDB was great. So at that point, it was this kind of really cocksure department. Jeremy hired us and Thierry and Damien. So we both pretty much arrived there at the same time. And it was crazy. It was just like you were working with all the names that you'd see written in the annuals. All of a sudden, they were sitting in the offices around you. And it was a very sharing environment as well. It wasn't like a closed door thing, although everyone had offices. Everyone was very open to sharing opinion about work and genuinely trying to make everyone else's work better, which you would think actually would be the opposite when, you know, everyone's kind of awards hungry, but genuinely there were so many briefs and embarrassment of riches, I guess. And so it never felt like there was much, it was literally like, everyone wanted to win awards and everyone wanted everyone else to win awards so that we were the most awarded. It was kind of like a fever that went on. It was a great time. We weren't great people. CDB was a good time. It was a good time to be there. And it was a good time in life. I think I turned 30 the day we joined. I then had, how long, I think we were at DB for about 3 years. 3 years of hard partying, hard drinking. It was about the right time in life. We would, you know, there was nothing like a lunch at the Cow to wipe out your arse. I think every week we went out and had a boozy lunch and then would come back and work. I mean, it was the proper sort of, if there were the heydays after the heydays of the 80s, I think DB at that point was definitely, we were living out the last of it.
That's great. I was actually having lunch with a friend of mine who I was at college with, who's now over in LA at the moment. I was saying how, do you remember how Friday basically just felt like it was a sort of over at lunchtime kind of day, or there wasn't quite as much work to be done on a Friday? And in the vibe of... Sorry?
It was a Tuesday, a Wednesday, a Thursday. It didn't matter at EDB. Somebody would go, let's go to Pizza Express. And Pizza Express meant you had to order at least 3 or 4 bottles of Valpolicella. And the thing was, you were going to split the bill. So if you didn't drink it, you were going to get screwed on the alcohol in any case. So you might as well drink it. And we would just go back. And then Ben and I would go back piss and just basically try and do work and then fall out about it because we were just a bit drunk.
Well, when I was at Y&R, the rule was from Mike Cousins, if you go out and get drunk at lunchtime, don't come back. Which I thought was a brilliant rule because on one side he was sort of going, well, you've gone and got drunk, which is taking some time off anyway. And then... you can have the afternoon off as well. And I'd like you to have the afternoon off. So I was sitting there going, advertising's amazing. Look what, like my boss is telling me to get drunk. Well, he isn't telling me to get drunk, but he understood. I mean, Mike Cousins was obviously there in the real heyday of things. So he understood how things were. But I think the whole idea of, and I think that kind of camaraderie that it comes up with and the sort of the banter. And you were obviously, I've met a lot of people or know a lot of people from that time as well. And they were very smart, very funny, very interesting people. So I would imagine that fosters a sort of atmosphere of, if not one-upmanship, then inspiring each other to go on and do better work. Is that how it felt?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. There wasn't that kind of like nasty cut and thrust that you get. I mean, I've never worked in a department like that actually, but I've heard about it, you know, where everyone's super protective over the briefs and everyone's trying to keep work from each other. DDB was great for teaching us that, and it was something that, you know, once we got to Adam and Eve as well, it was, you know, we, you know, along with Ben Priest engendered within our department, it was, you know, trying to get everyone to work for the greater good, really, rather, you know, because if you bring in good people and everyone is good, I don't know, it just makes a better working environment. It's a much nicer place and people are generally more positive, and I think better work comes out of that.
Yeah, so I don't know if you heard the Simon Vexner chat I had, but he speaks incredibly highly of actually working for Jeremy and what Jeremy is like as a CD. How was your experience of that?
I think the department he built for us was great. He definitely did that. And he allowed everyone to kind of have their head. And, you know, we all went down to Cannes together. That was great. I mean, I guess in terms of work, yeah, I mean, we did some great work there. Jeremy CD'd it. Do you know what? It's really, it's like in the fog of time. I can't really pick out. He was great to work for. He either loved it or he hated it. And, you know, we sometimes felt, you know, like he should have loved that. but he'd be like, no, it's shit. he was a funny man, so you know, he knew his mind, he really knew his own mind. So you know, you either fell foul of it, or you championed and you made the work you wanted to. But there's no doubt, yeah, that at that point he ran an amazing department.
And obviously you did a whole load of really good work while you were there, but I think a lot of people would remember most clearly the Harvey Nichols stuff with the ice cube and the blowtorch and things like that. Did you feel like when you were coming up with that it was a real winner, that you'd really kind of got something really good in your hands? And did that affect the way you treated how you're going to execute it?
I'm not sure if we did or not. I mean, Harvey Nichols, on those briefs, the bar was so high at that point. So Justin and Adam had won like major awards. I think this was the campaign after Calendar. It could have been, I can't remember, but so there was massive pressure, and it was by no means the first thing we came up with. And I think we'd done quite a few other things beforehand. So by the time we got to that, it was a bit like, well, this could be good. But I can't remember how we felt about it, to be honest. I think it was just like, oh, this is we were really like, this is interesting. And yeah, Justin and Adam CD'd it. We got a great guy, Dimitri Danilov, to shoot it. And I don't know, I guess we hoped for it. That was it, really. I don't think none of our work were we ever cocky enough to say this is going to win, because I have this feeling, like, occasionally when we would secretly admit to ourselves that we thought this was really going to win, and well, we didn't.
Yeah.
So it was in backwards. So I think we always kept our feet on the ground slightly, and we're always like, look, we'll make it the best we can, and we'll send it off with a fair wind, and we'll cross our fingers. Because I don't think you can ever guess juries either. I mean, I think you can have a good idea about what pleases them, but you can never go, we've got gold here. And I think that surprises actually how much Harvey Nichols did win, to be honest. We weren't expecting it. It did really well. And that's when the Clio's and One Show, I think we'd always respected One Show, but the Clio started to come through. And was it Cannes? I can't remember. There was definitely some gongage going on in any case, which was nice.
Nice. So how long, so you did 3 years there, but how long before, did Ben Priest come calling, or was that Liz Harold again?
We had met, yeah, it was Liz Harold, yeah. Yeah, everyone deals through Liz Harold. We'd actually spoken to Ben. Ben through Liz Harold. We'd had chats about going to Rainy Kelly, because Ben was at the time at Rainy Kelly, but we didn't feel that it was the right time for us to go to Rainy Kelly. And interestingly, so when Adam and Eve launched, which would have been, I think, in the spring of 2008, there was an article in Campaign, and Ben and I both commented that that would be something we would be very interested in doing, but we never, there was no point. You don't approach a startup who've got no money and say, hey, do you want to hire some expensive creatives? So we kind of just, I think we had that conversation and then forgot about it. I can't quite remember. I think it was around August time that the negotiations began, and we got a call from Liz saying, would you like to go in and meet Ben? They're looking to hire a senior creative team. And then we went over there and said, you don't want to hire a senior creative team. That's not us. We're a creative director team. You need to hire us as creative directors. And God bless them, they did.
That's quite interesting, because Daryl and I actually interviewed for that job. Obviously, we didn't get it because you did. But I don't know if it was because, I mean, now you're saying it's 2008. I was trying to remember what the hell was going on at 2008. But we definitely went in to meet Ben in their offices on the ones that were sort of above Stringfellows, if my memory serves.
Yeah, that's where we started out, on a building site, basically.
Yeah, it says a lot about me that I'm going, it's above Stringfellows rather than it's in Upper St. Martin's Lane or whatever. Not that I've ever been to Stringfellows, but... I think it's quite interesting that obviously they had an ambition to have a team of that kind of level, and then to sort of take them to the next level. So what was it like being in a completely different environment to DDB, in a sort of startup, and again with Ben as a boss?
It was really energizing, actually. We had, in one of our many long chats that Ben and I had, had decided that DDB was slightly too comfortable for us. It was like, I think we likened it to something like a comfortable chair or a warm bath on any given day it changed. And we decided that we were too happy and too comfortable, and that we should get out of our comfort zone and go and experience something else. And Adam and Eve was definitely that. It took us out of our comfort zone, but in a great way. And I mean, we had no idea how well it was going to work out or not work out. And we definitely procrastinated that one to death. I see seem to remember that we had quite a few meetings with them, and we kept on sort of, I think, in the background going, oh, we're not sure. And we'd wound down the clock, and we'd signed our letter, but we hadn't given it to them. And I was like, you know what, Ben, this is getting rude. I'm going to take the letter in first thing in the morning, and then it's done. And I remember walking into the offices and handing the letter to James Murphy, accepting the job. And I said, I can't remember what I said. I said something about, you know, oh, you know, it was just, we couldn't work out whether, you know, it's going to work out or not. And he went, oh, well, don't worry. If it doesn't work out, you can always go and get another job at BBH or something, can't you? And so yeah, I think they'd had enough of us cooking around. I don't blame them, to be honest. When I tried to hire people, I wouldn't want to hire us. We were a right old pain in the ass to try and hire. But Adam and Eve was very different, and we were kind of parachuted. But probably because we worked at Miles Calcroft, not quite at the same stage of inception as an agency, we were quite realistic about what was going to happen, and they didn't have a department as such. There was Ben, and I. And then very junior teams. I think there might have been placement. I'm not sure they had teams. They had placement teams. And so we were working. We were writing. We weren't creative directors. Although we were creative directors in title, we didn't have anyone to creative direct. So we creative directed ourselves. So but to begin with, we were helping the younger teams and really writing a lot of the work ourselves that we, you know. So that's kind of how it started. And it's kind of funny because I read the other day that Adam and Eve Dibina have 50 teams. And I can't believe how in the beginning, how hard it was to hire people. We would be trying to tell them how great Adam and Eve was going to be, and they would be laughing in our faces. And they would all kind of go, yes, not right now. Come back in a few years' time. So, I'm like, ha ha, see, you wouldn't be saying that now.
And how did the dynamic work with Ben Priest then? Because I guess in such a small sort of situation, did he not want to have input in the work? And was that sort of encroaching on what you thought was your CD territory a bit? Or was that okay?
No, I think, from the very beginning, we looked after different things, I think. I think Ben had some stuff and we were working on bits and pieces. And Ben Priest isn't a meddlesome man at all. He really sort of let, I think, you know, one of his big talents is he just lets people get on with stuff. And that was really important. I think Ben's got this amazing, he's got an amazing talent for hiring good people. I don't say that because he hired us. He's hired some brilliant, brilliant people since then. And what he does, he doesn't hire them and then impose himself on them. He hires them because they're great people and because he believes they can do great work. And then he gives them the space to do that. So that was very much the case with Ben and I. And it was nice because we really were like up against it. I think agencies always work really well when they're up against something and they've got a challenge and they know what they sort of want to do. And we really felt that quite acutely. I don't think there was kind of a feeling within the industry, I think, that perhaps Adam and Eve really going to do anything great creatively? There was kind of question marks over it. And the three of us really believed deeply that of course we could do great stuff. And it was that, I think it was that belief that really bound us together and drove us forward. And it was a really important thing, actually. I think if everyone from the outside had been like, oh, well, of course this agency will just do the best work in the world, I don't think that would have actually been as motivating for us as the fact that people doubted what we could do. And it's funny, I bet a lot of people now would look back and go, oh, I never doubted them, but they did. I mean, the amount of conversations I had with creatives who would be like, you're crazy, what are you doing? This is the most stupid thing you've ever done. And, you know, of course, it wasn't, because it's only stupid if you let it be stupid. We weren't going to. We were going to drive it forward and make it great. So no, the Ben and Emma dynamic actually worked really well.
That's cool. So obviously there was a huge amount of fame and awardage happening, gongage, as you just said, from John Lewis over that time. But what were the other accounts and pieces of work that you thought really kind of started to propel the creative reputation of Adam and Eve forward?
Well, the first thing we ever did that got sort of published, I say published now, that's not the word, ran.
Yeah.
The first thing that ran was a small campaign for the Telegraph, and it was just print and posters, and it was the first thing that the agency had done, I think, that that got any kind of recognition, critical sort of recognition, and that kind of kick-started it. And it was that, we can do this, we can do something good. And then we won John Lewis, and I mean, you know, again, there was no expectation that was that I think from the outside, that we were going to do anything with it. Lowe's had done some nice work. And again, I think the industry was kind of thinking, yeah, what are they going to do? And I mean, it wasn't like the gongs flew in straight away. We did, you know, they kind of, it started off, I think we got a BTAA, is that what they call it? For the work we did with Benito for the first year. And then it sort of slowly snowballed from there. And there was, yeah. And I think that confidence, that idea that we could do work that was, it kind of permeated through the agency, and everyone kind of got that sort of awards fever and, or wanted to do good work, because it wasn't Adam and Eve. It wasn't all about awards. It was kind of about, there was two things going on. I think Ben and I were like, we must win awards, and then James and Eugene and the partners were kind of like, yeah, but we want to do stuff that, you know, is good for our clients. And actually, we managed to melt. John Lewis was great for actually bringing those two things together, and a lot of other clients like Foster's and lots of other things we did kind of managed to bridge that gap.
Cool. Weirdly enough, I had lunch with James Studholme last Friday. He was in town. And we talked about More Than a Woman, because I had just been watching Dougal's DNAD talk, where he showed his crap-o-matic of you guys all crawling around some room, sort of showing how it was going to happen. And then we also discussed, at that time, there was a weird fever pitch of sort of furore of, if someone had seen anything vaguely like it before somewhere on the internet, then there was this, oh, it's been nicked or ripped off or something. And he told us how utterly gutted Dougal was about that. And I remember that someone found some Italian ad or whatever and put some music on it. I mean, how did that feel at the time? Did it, because, you know, in no way was that Italian ad the inspiration for what you did, but did it take the shine off it at all?
Well, it's funny, isn't it? At the time, I remember being really gutted, because you kind of feel like you can't, there's no forum to stand up and say, hold on a minute, I've never seen this ad. I mean, we genuinely, hand on heart, on my children's lives, we'd never seen that piece. I mean, why on earth would we search the internet for a really obscure Italian ad that we didn't even know existed? It would be very strange. So I think at the time we were really like affronted by it and upset that a piece of work that we had really slogged over, you know, you saw the crap-o-matic that Dougal made. Yeah. There was just months and months of work went into that from so many people, and it was such a big project for John Lewis, and there was so much trust from the client. At the time, I think we were just like, we were really angry. It's almost like, I imagine it's how, you know, when people get, celebrities get outed by the Sun, and they're like, what? I feel outraged. It felt a bit like that. But I've forgotten all about it, to be honest. It's funny, time just, you forget those things.
Yeah.
And it's just like, people say, what have you done? I kind of just cite that ad, and it's just like, yeah. And I think everyone's forgotten. Do you know what I mean? I don't think anyone actually, unless you'd mentioned it, and probably James remembers it because, you know, he was there at the time, but the rest of the public never would remember. I don't think the ad community does either.
Not at all. So I guess it's interesting to have a really big success with that and then do the difficult second album syndrome. But, you know, your subsequent work for John Lewis was also, you know, really amazing. And I don't know which one set the template for, we're now going to do a 60-second, somewhat, not serious, I guess it was the one with the little kid who wanted to give his parents the present. But that has now set a template for, I'm not kidding, it gets mentioned over here in America a lot, where it's like, they want to do a John Lewis, or that one where the kid, you know, gives a present to the dad. It's like, you invented a genre of advertising. I assume accidentally, or was there a sort of method to what you're trying to do?
No, it was kind of it was the strangest thing. I think the first ad we did, which had the Sweet Child of Mine track on it, so there was a few things there that kind of started to set a trend, which we had no idea at the time would become a trend. So first of all, that it was long format, but at that time there was a lot of doubt over TV, and there was kind of like people were doing 30s, and we were really keen that we make it a 60 or a 90. It was kind of like it had to have a spectacle to it. And then there was the sort of inevitable debate over music, and it was a Fleet Foxes track that nearly went on it, and then I can't remember who it was. They're going to kill. Oh no! I think it was David Golding. Let's give him some credit where credit's due. I think he said, "I've heard this recording of Sweet Child of Mine." I think it was him, and it was like, "Yeah, this is great. We should put this on." And little did we know then that was then going to set the precedent for every other re-record of a popular track from then on in. I don't think anyone twigged that at all. And then it has been, that has been the house standard. And people obviously laugh about it now, like, who is going to do the cover of the famous track for John Lewis? But yeah, they were all things that at the time just seemed important for themselves. It was never a grand plan. It was never a grand plan. Actually, the second Christmas ad we made, I think the music was probably ended up being more famous than the spot, because I think Kate and Wills played it at their wedding. And then the, I can't remember when Always a Woman came out, and then there was the one you said, the boy waking his parents up on Christmas Day with the present. It just kind of slowly slotted into place. There seemed to be a John Lewis style for those ads. It's crazy, actually, because I was always quite cynical. I was like, we're going to drop the ball at any minute. We're going to drop it. We're going to fumble it. And, it's been amazing that it hasn't, it's continued on and on and on. I'm ever so proud of being involved in that piece of work.
And I guess what's really interesting is the level of public fame it's had. I mean, I was like, I follow this vague Viz top tips thing on Twitter occasionally, and they sort of like, I can't remember what it was recently, but they were mentioning, oh, it must be time for the John Lewis Christmas ad now. So years after, you still have this thing where the public are waiting for this ad. And I guess, I don't know if there's a specific story or anything where you realize it had reached this tipping point of being so utterly famous in the country, the whole John Lewis ad thing. Was it a slow change into that?
Yeah, I think it was probably slower than we realized, but it was, I think when Channel 4 started running a teaser or a trailer for it, you started to realize it's got a bit nuts. It's like, who runs a teaser for a commercial? I think Always a Woman, the papers picked up on.
Right.
It just slowly, I think, crept into the public consciousness. And we sort of had a few good ones on the bounce, and then everyone was like, well, what's the next one? And so public expectation went up, and John Lewis ended up owning the Christmas market, which is amazing.
And just from the inside, so when I don't know how much you were involved with this sort of question, but when you're sort of talking to Lily Allen about her cover or whatever it happens to be, does it become a big deal for the record companies to go, can we please get our song on there and our artists on there?
Yeah, it did. I think once people realised the amount of, the amount of TVRs, is that the right word? The amount of TV viewing you were going to get along with the online stuff. Yeah, it definitely, became. I think it went from us approaching, we used a lovely lady called Abby Leland, about her approaching people and them being like, us kind of basically having to ask them, to them asking her whether they could do it. So yeah, I think the balance well and truly changed.
Cool. So I mean, I guess then you'd reached this point where Adam and Eve had got really big and was obviously very attractive to DDB in a sort of reverse takeovery situation. What happened there?
It's all a bit of a blur now. Yeah, so obviously the partners negotiated with Omnicom, that we were all back off to Bishop's Bridge Road, which was the only thing I was gutted about was the Bishop's Bridge Road bit, to be honest. Because when I walked out of the revolving doors of Paddington, I decided I was never ever going back to Paddington unless it was to catch a train. but sure enough, we were going back again. And it was strange. It must have been very strange for them, as strange as it is for us, because none of the partners had any history there, but we were walking straight back in and above a lot of the teams, that we'd been working with, which was, I'm sure, was a little bit strange for them. But, it was, it was all handled incredibly well. And we were back at DDB, and we were Adam and Eve DDB. And it's kind of strange.
So were you Jeremy's boss then? Just out of interest, how did that happen?
No, because Jeremy was something very different. So yeah, so we were the ECDs of Anime, but Jeremy, I can't actually remember, because Jeremy looked after Volkswagen, so that was all he did. And actually, that's it. He wasn't actually he wasn't Adam and Eve DDB. He was employed by DDB Europe. Right. I'm going to get this really wrong and get into trouble, but I think that was the thing. So no, there was all along the short is there was no way that we were Jeremy's boss. No, Jeremy was his own boss and we were ours.
Okay. So it was a little bit odd, but I guess you just got on with it and you know, it's the next phase and the next stage of an agency situation. So did it feel different being in the sort of bosom of a large holding company as opposed to being the vibe of the startup for those few years when you're making Adam and Eve work? Must have been very different to being like, now we're in this big pucker part of Omnicom, really. And how did that change the way you approached your work or not?
No, not at all. In fact, our kind of like mantra when we went there was that we were going to maintain the energy of a startup. That was really important to us, or at least a small agency, and take that vibe with us. And that, I think, is exactly, we managed to do it. I mean, you know, it's hard to make a kind of arranged marriage work when, you know, both sides are coming from quite different places. But yeah, I think we brought with us an energy, and I think because of the DNA of, I was talking about AdWanks, because the DNA of DEB was that they already knew what good work was and they already wanted to do it, and we just helped facilitate that. So yeah, it kind of, yeah, I think if there was, it worked from both sides. DEB really wanted to, it still had at the core of it, a want to do good work. We were at that point doing great work, and you know, we came together and yeah, it worked. I mean, I don't know how the chemistry that was there worked.
Okay, and I'll ask this question in the knowledge that you may not be able to answer it fully, but I think people would be interested to know what it's like being bought out by a big company and having a sort of earn-out period, and what the responsibilities of that feel like, and do you feel like you've got to put more business on, and did you have targets where if you didn't, I don't know what any of that's really like, so I don't know how much you can talk about that, but what's that side of that?
Well, it wasn't something that we really got that involved with, or at least I personally didn't. So I can't really comment on that. I mean, the agency, Adam and Eve, were just always very conscientious about doing good work and creating the best they could do. I don't think, you know, it was, That I think has become quite clear that their intention wasn't just to kind of go in there and go, yeah, fuck it, it's about the money, because they continue to do great work. So yeah, I can't really comment, because I don't really know. I wasn't doing those high level meetings. So yeah, I'm afraid I can't really give you any juicy gossip now.
All right. And was it interesting to get back onto those same clients again? Did you still have like Marmite and Harvey Nicks and all those kind of things to do?
It was great. Yeah, it was brilliant. It was like, you know, here you go, here you've got some of, you know, it was clients that we would have pitched for and been at Adam and Eve and really wanted to win. So it was amazing that we could join, you know, our kind of like increasingly brilliant client list. All of a sudden, I think that was one of the PowerPoint presentations we did when we joined the agency. It was like, look, you've got all these great clients, and we've got all these great clients, and hey, guess what? Now we're an agency and we can do all of them together. So all the DDB creatives kind of came on board and could write a John Lewis ad or crack any of our briefs, and equally we could go and crack theirs. So no, it was brilliant. It was like a sweet trip. It was like, well, hey, we've just got 50% more.
Sounds excellent. So again, I don't know how much you can or want to talk about this, but you don't really work there any longer, and you've now you know, you're several years into a pretty successful career as an author. I was going to say children's author, just in case there are other things you're sort of planning to do. So how did that sort of, how did it come about? But was there an itch you wanted to scratch, and how long had it been there as an ambition?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard. I know that basically the first thing I wrote that your son actually read and yes, was so Loved positive it. About, which is part of the reason I have pursued it. Thank you very much to
Jackson. Yeah.
Thank you, Jackson. It was I wrote it actually when I was at Adam and Eve, and it was kind of just born out of this. I don't know. I felt like creatively we'd ended up in a sort of position that was more managerial than creative, and although we were still creating, it was more about overseeing work. And I think I started to increasingly feel that that was a position that, although, you know, I really enjoyed it and I really enjoyed bringing on teams, that I kind of missed doing creative work for myself. And so I started writing, and I mean, the reason it's a children's book is because I think I'm just very childish. I started writing really just almost as a kind of therapy in the evenings, just so that I could do something for me that, you know, I didn't have to take into a meeting and justify. I didn't have to have endless conversations about that was just something, yeah, something private. And so I initially did it for that, and I really enjoyed drawing, but I had no reason to draw. So I thought, well, you know, I'll illustrate the book. And it sort of just became a pet project. And I created this book. And yeah, and then, like I say, I showed it to your son, who was very kind about it. And then I showed it to a few more people who were equally kind about it. And then it was a kind of just a journey that I'd never planned to take. And I just thought, oh, well, what's the worst that can happen? I can send this off a la J.K. Rowling and get all my kind of rejection letters back, which I did. I think I sent it to 8 or 9 places, and it was literally like it had been scripted this way, that I got 8 rejections, like, you know, through the, I think it's 6 months. I mean, publishing is so glacially slow, and it was rejection, 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 rejection. And the very last one, it had to be the very last one, was an email just saying, I've read a bit of it and I quite like it. I presume that someone's already snapped this up. What should I read on? And I think I rang Gabby, actually, because I knew that you'd had some, you know, obviously you'd been published. And I was just like, what the hell do I say? And she was like, just say that maybe you have had some interest. So maybe I have had some interest. And that was a guy called James Catchpole who became my agent. It was a long process, because even if you have a manuscript, it's, you know, until it's published, it's just a manuscript. And I think I waited another sort of 6 months after that conversation, and then they eventually sold it to Scholastic.
Well, it's great. I mean, it is a really, really good kids book, and obviously my son enjoyed it enormously, but I've read it many, many times because my son and daughter have enjoyed it enormously. And I think a lot of people think writing kids books is easy because, you know, in certain kids books there's like about 300 words, and that's pretty easy, isn't it? But I think it's very deceptive. I was reading one yesterday about a dinosaur doing a poo, and I thought, this really isn't very good compared to what Emma wrote. But how did you then do the transition of sort of easing off one side of your career and easing into the other one?
I decided to have a child.
Yeah.
I thought the best thing I can do to force myself out of the advertising industry for a period of time without actually asking for a sabbatical, which didn't really feel right, was to get pregnant. So I worked got myself a husband, so I went on maternity leave just as the first book was published, and as the book was published, they offered me another two book deal. So whilst I was on maternity leave, I wrote the second book, and I literally went back to work as I think that was about to be published, or it was going to print. And that year off had given me time to kind of consider a lot of things about my life. I'd had kind of like some hard things happen in my life. My mother had passed away, and I kind of keenly felt that she'd passed away young, and that it made me ask a lot of questions about what I was doing, and whether, you know, if I were to pass away at that age, would I be really happy with the choices that I was continuing to make about my work, and if I had children. I don't know, it threw up a lot of things, and I'd really enjoyed writing, and I just decided that I wasn't going to get this chance again. If I didn't give everything to being an author, that it would never really, I couldn't run the two things together.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure I could stay in advertising and always wonder what could have happened. And luckily I was in a position financially where I could make that decision. So yeah, and I went back to work for a while, and I explained my situation to the partners, and they were very understanding, and we left on very, very amicable terms. And then I sort of slowly sunk into a world of publishing, which is very different to the world of advertising in terms of just the speed of everything is very slow. Like I say, it's not easy writing books. I finished writing the series of pig books I'm writing, and now I'm trying to write something else, you know, and it's not easy. Those 300 words, every word counts in a 300 word book.
Absolutely.
It's very different, but it's interesting because I'm learning. So, you know, I've learned so much about a whole new world that I never knew existed. So I've really, really enjoyed that. I've read a lot of books about writing, and and I've written a lot of things and had them critiqued, and I've tried to learn from that.
That's cool. James Statham actually also told me that Simon Pegg or Nick Frost have optioned the books to make an animated series. Is that true?
Yeah, TV series. Actually, just as you called, I was reading. So I've also had the joy of learning to read scripts in Final Draft. It's really weird. Yeah. It's quite weird. Scripts are quite different from TV scripts. You have to learn to write them in a different way. So I was writing these like short films for Pig, and they were like written like advertising. And I think everyone's looking at me going, "What the hell is this strange script, girl? What is it?" So yeah, it's like, right, we need to use Final Draft.
Yeah.
Actually, that was really nice. So Big Talk, who are the production company that I think part owned by Simon and Nick, came through my agent and offered to option the books. And they'd never made children's TV content before, and they wanted to, and they wanted Pig to be the first thing they made. So I was very excited. And this started, I think, around the time that I left Adam and Eve. And this has been really slow because I have to find funding. But what's been really nice about that is that Blink also were interested in working on the project. So I hooked the two of them up, and now actually Blink are the animation partner. So right now we are making a pilot for the TV series of I Is Pig. So yeah, that's all happening. So yeah, at the moment there's a writer who's writing the scripts, and myself and the exec producer are overseeing that script, and then Blink are starting doing the animation, and then hopefully Simon and Nick are going to end it up in a sound studio saying some of the crazy stuff that's come out of my head in the past few years.
I think that'd be fantastic. I think they'd be exactly right for the for the people to bring that to life. Cool. Well, I mean, we've got to just over an hour, and we've got to, I guess, the present day. So we could kind of, I guess, stop there, unless there's... Well, as I always end up saying to the other people I've spoken to, is there anything else you wanted to say? Because, I mean, it's not that this is some giant forum for all the people in advertising to listen to this great proclamation you've always wanted. Tim Ferriss, on his blog, he always goes, if you could have a billboard anywhere in the world, where would it be and what would it say? And I'm not asking that. But is there anything else you wanted to say at all about anything?
I don't think so, and I'd never be able to answer the billboard question. Mine would be a shelf in a bookshop. I'd like my own shelf in a bookshop. That would be nice, where I like all the books are my books. I'm not sitting alongside anyone else. That's my new want in life.
Fantastic. Okay, well, thanks so much for taking the time, and I'll put this up in a couple of weeks, because I think I've got Dave, and then I might speak to Mary Weir this week. We'll see how that goes. And I'll send it to you beforehand, just so you can check it out. But thanks so much. It's lovely to speak to you, because we obviously don't carving out an hour to have a chat is not something we do ever. But it's been really, really nice. Cool. So if you'd like to tell Adam that I'll be knocking on his door for a similar chat at some point in the near future, that'd be brilliant. But otherwise, thanks so much, Emma. And I'll.
People have been watching your podcast, because he was like, yeah, these creators at work keep telling me about Ben K's podcast. So they're obviously, listen, sorry, not watching. You're obviously getting an audience over here.
Yeah, I think they're generally doing about, you know, somewhere between 500 and 1,000 downloads or listens each. Yeah, so there'll be, I think there's, you know, getting enough feedback, but I can see the figures, but obviously no one else really can. But yeah, there's plenty of people listening, unless it's one person downloading it 1,000 times, which I really doubt. But
Gabby,
exactly. You have bumping up my figures. Okay, well, thanks, Emma, and have a great rest of your Tuesday.
And you take care, mate. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
To watch Christmas.